session number 31044, reel 4.
HMT Scathedon for the second time. It brought me back from South Africa, and now it was taking me out to India. But this time, with the war being well on, the Mediterranean was now open, so we didn't have to go around the Cape. So we went through the Mediterranean, and we got to Bombay in 1 month. It took exactly 1 month to get to Bombay. And from Bombay...
Did anything of...
Bombay was a holding camp.
Did anything of event happen on the voyage?
No, nothing. No, nothing of note. No, no. And then I was sent with my crew to Pune to do what was known as a jungle course. This was given by hardened old soldiers that taught you how to survive in the jungle in case you were shot down, including catching and cooking snakes and things like that. And they had a passing out test. I can still, the camp was actually just outside Pune in the western Ghats of India. And the passing out test, you were taken in a closed lorry out into the semi-scrubby jungle, and it kept going zigzagging all over the place. Your navigator was given a map and compass, and he had to try and figure out where you had got to. So after 3 or 4 hours of this zigzagging about, we were toughed out and we had to find our way back to Pune, you see, and the lorry went off in a different direction altogether from what it had come. It didn't give us a clue at all. So there we were, 5 of us, standing there wondering what to do, because the navigator said, I haven't got a bloody clue. He said, that thing was, the compass was just useless. So I said, well, there's a little hill up there, it's about maybe 500-600 feet high. Why don't we go up there and maybe we'll be able to see something? Good idea. So we climbed up this little hill and got to the top, looked down the other side, and there was a road. So we went down to the road. 5 minutes later, a bus came along, marked Pune. We were on the bus, and we were banking camp before the lorry. Marvellous. So we had to hide for a bit. So there we go, Pune. Pune. Oh, yes. I went to a heavy conversion unit at Kolar in the Mysore province. That's not too far from Bangalore, where I converted onto four-engine liberators. And we were there for 18th, 24th, 6th. That took quite a while. 18th of the 1st to the 24th, just over a month. Would that be right?
How did you find the Indian climate?
The climate in India? Well, in the particular part of India where the squadron was, it was very humid indeed, and that was in the Calcutta area. And just prior to the monsoon, it was unbearable. It really was. The sweat was lashing off you every pore. And I didn't like it all that much at all.
Did that have any effect on the aircraft operations?
Yes, it had the effect that the tanks, after a bit, were rubberized and they melted, and they had to have tank changes in Liberators. Well, these tank changes were traumatic because the fitters had to spend so much time on the silver wings of these aircraft with the sun absolutely. Well, I was really sorry for them. A lot of them succumbed to heat pressure and heat related diseases. It was really bad for them. Yeah. Cola, that's what I'm looking for. May 29th. And then we went to 355 Squadron at Salboni. And this is where I started my operational career.
What sort of reception did you get when you arrived? At the squadron?
Can't remember, really. You see, there was a few of us, and we knew each other. And I was assigned to fly with a Tasmanian called Dal Gledo. Half the squadron was Australian, 355 Squadron. And he put the fear of death up me, actually, because he had a kind of tick in his neck here. And take off in a bomber was probably one of the worst times, because you're fully loaded, fully bombed up, and it's a matter of can you get off in time. So when Dal was on takeoff, this tick in his neck was gone. Oh, I'm sitting there and the sweat lashing off him, you know. It's not very confidence-giving. 355 Squadron, to let you understand, was one of six squadrons. Three stations, each station having two squadrons. And 355 and 356 were on the same station at Salboni, near Calcutta, 50 miles from Calcutta. And our job was to cut the Japanese lines of communication. All the rivers in Thailand and Japan and Burma and north-south, there was the Kwai, the famous one, the Setang, the Salween, the Irrawaddy, all running north-south, all having to be bridged by the Japanese to feed their troops in Burma who were fighting the 14th Army. And our job was to prevent the Japanese getting their supplies to the front line. And this involved various operations, low level, bridge busting, train busting, high level in places like Rangoon, the marshalling yards, to stop the trains getting up to the Mandalay area, shipping strikes, where they were bringing troop ships along the coast. So it was it's quite a varied operational. And the Japanese defences, the flak at Rangoon was very good. The fighters were good enough, but if the Liberators were in daylight formation, the fighters didn't really have a chance, because the Liberators, for a start, had 0.5 guns. And the Japanese were still on 303s. And they couldn't press an attack the way the Germans did. The Germans really pressed an attack to 150 yards, something like that. The Japanese were more or less forced to break off at 600 yards. Added to which, the fighters were very agile, but they had sacrificed weight for performance. So the pilots were very lightly protected with armour, not like our pilots, who had a really solid sheet behind them in the Spitfires and the Hurricanes.
This was in the Zeros, wasn't it?
The Zeros and the Oscars, yes. Uh-huh. So we didn't worry too much about the fighters. We did, if our trips were quite long on the whole. Some of the trips were fairly short, and in these shorter trips, and by a short trip I mean 6, 7, 8 hours, we had fighter escorts. The fighter escorts to start with were American P-47s, Thunderbolts, and they were useless. They didn't have the agility of the Japanese fighters at all. And if there was a clash between the Thunderbolts and the Zeros won. So the Thunderbolts eventually, they could only make one pass. After that, they had to get out of it quick. So they were replaced by P-38 Lightnings. And they were terrific, absolutely marvellous. And they had the legs on the Japs, both for speed and for manoeuvrability. And for the short trips, their protection was bang on. The longer trips, we had to rely on a loose formation and firepower for defence. And, of course, an awful lot of the operations were conducted at low level. And in these cases, you were subject to ground fire. But once again, firepower of a Liberator. Biggest coup in the RAF, incidentally. 11 in the coup. Because of the long trips, you had to have two of everything. Two pilots, two wireless ops, flight engineer, navigator, gunners, two waist gunners, rear gunner, mid-upper gunner, front gunner, and then football team in every crew. Or as the Australians used to say, a cricket team in every crew. So that's about my... monsoon came up. Flying stopped. Nobody could fly in the monsoon. Sitting in the crew room, I can remember it quite vividly, playing battleships with a friend of mine, and the flight commander came into the crew room and said, "Anybody here interested in mountaineering?" "Yes, yes." "Right," he says, "CO wants to see you." So, what the hell's all this about? So I went up to see the CO. And the CO says, "Well, it's like this." He said, "The Maharaja of Kashmir, one Hari Singh, H-A-R-I, not Hari, has offered to accommodate two expired air crew up in the Himalayas. And he set up a camp at 10,000 feet, or 10,000 feet, yeah. And because the only people he saw prior to the war were climbers coming up through Kashmir, you see. And he thought all Englishmen or Scotsmen were keen on climbing. And the trouble was that they'd been round all the tour expired people who were not interested at all. All they wanted was to go to the fly spots of Bombay and Calcutta, you see, after they'd done a tour of Alps to hell with climbing up bloody mountains, you see. Then they went round the squadrons in desperation because they didn't want to offend the Maharaja of Kashmir. And they finally turned up about half a dozen blokes, including a pal of mine, Joe MacArthur from 356 Squadron. So Joe and I were given travel warrants for Rawalpindi. And this entailed going to Calcutta, first of all, and flying up to Delhi, where I had the ignominy of being airsick on a Dakota, having been on ops for 6 months, flying the thing myself, airsick flying as a passenger. And it was full of army people as well, were laughing their bloody heads off, you know, me and my wing. So from Delhi, we took the train to Rawalpindi. And from Rawalpindi, we took a gharry up to the area for a convalescence station up at a place called Lower Topa, near Murray in the foothills of the Himalayas, where all the beer in India was made. I don't know why they put the RAF station there, but it's a good idea, yes. Murray beer was, all the beer consumed in India was made up in Murray. And we stayed in Murray for acclimatising. It was at 8,000 feet or thereabouts. And I remember playing in a football match and getting very puffed out after 5 minutes. And from Murray we went by car again over to Srinagar in Kashmir, where it had been arranged that we'd stay in houseboats on the Shalimar, Dal Lake by the Shalimar Gardens. And we stayed in the houseboats for a week or so. Srinagar's quite high as well, it's about 8,000-9,000 feet. And then we trekked for 3 days up to our base camp at Sonamarg at 10,000 feet. And from there, we were sort of sorted out into the climbers and non-climbers. And I was assigned to go with Wilfred Noyce, the really top-class climber. So we got up to... Our next camp was at 14,000 feet, and from there we climbed up to very close on 19,000. And that was a great time. Meanwhile, the squadron had no way of getting in touch with me, and I was up there for something like 2 months. Eventually, they got a telegram to come back, always forgiven, sort of stuff. We need you. So back to this squadron I went, and found out that they didn't want me for operations anymore. They told me my tour of operations was over, although it wasn't. I'd only done about 10 or 11, something like that. But they wanted me to go to Canada to pick up and train another crew because they were short of aircraft. So very good news indeed, yes. There were about a dozen of us sent from Salmoni, posted to Boundary Bay, Vancouver in Canada. But on the way across in the boat, we came back to the Cape Town Castle, which was great because I was a warrant officer by this time and had a cabin to myself. It was smashing there. When I think back to the Ormond down below being sick all over the place, Cape Town Castle was terrific. Got to Liverpool and found that the end of the war was imminent and our posting had been cancelled. Much to the disgust of the three Canadian pilots that were with us, you know, they were looking forward to us going back to Canada again. So from there on in, it was a case of posting here, there and everywhere, finding something to do. I went to a place called Wheaton Ashton, where I ferried aircraft to Sirot for breaking up. The war had finished. The war with Germany finished in May 45, and the war with Japan finished in August. So that's my career. I finished up at Grangemouth, where they made me station warrant officer, which was wonderful, because I met my wife there, and we also had a very good deal with the breweries. Grangemouth had been an operational training unit with Spitfires and had 120 non-commissioned officers there and were still getting the beer ration and whiskey ration for 120 non-commissioned officers. There was only 12 of us. So we didn't let on. What we did was we arranged dances in the town hall in Grangemouth with a bar, and we made a huge profit. So much so that in the mess, you didn't have to pay for any drinks. Everything was free. In the Sergeant Bilker would have been absolutely proud of us. So there I was until finally demobbed. And demobbed in... Uxbridge on the 16th of July 1946, because I'd signed on for another 6 months. I was having such a whale of a time at Grangemouth.
How did the demo process work for you? How did the demo process work for you?
How did the
demobilisation process work for you?
I'm sorry, I'm not...
What happened during the demobilisation process?
Oh, yes, uh-huh. Well, as far as I can remember, you went down to Axbridge and you were given a choice of a suit or a sports jacket and flannels and a Trilby hat. And I can't remember much about it, to tell you the truth. It was hardly worth going all the way to Axbridge, I know that. And, of course, after that, I went back to my civilian job in the post office and found that I'd dropped about £4 a week. You know, going back as a civilian, I was making more in the RAF because, you know, I was a warrant officer on flying pay. The pay was quite good and it was all found. So, it was hard going. I remember my wife and I, we got married shortly after I left the RAF in 1940. January 48 we were married. And my wage at the time was £4.16 and 9 per week. That was post-war. So it was hardly enough. We had a furnished flat in Glasgow, which was £2 per week. So that left us living costs of £2.16 and 9. So I desperately tried everything. First of all, I thought, well, with my flying experience, I've got 2,000 hours. I might be able to get a job in civil airlines. Oh, no, no. They had such a choice. They weren't taking anybody with less than 5,000 hours. So that was that. However, I did sit the examinations and got into the customs and excise. And that built up a big upturn in our fortunes. And then 2 years after demob, I got nostalgic for flying and joined the reserve again. And I was in the reserve until 1956 or thereabouts, when my eyesight was such that I couldn't pass the medical. So, and then, of course, at the age of 60, I retired from the customs and excise, saw a job advertised as a golf professional in Teignmouth Castle. I didn't apply for it. I phoned up the fellow that was doing the interviews and said, I see you're looking for a 40-year-old golf professional. Yes, that's right. Well, I'm a 60-year-old amateur. Oh, I could practically see him saying to his secretary, I've got a right one here, yes. But it was very nice. He said, well, I'm afraid you're not what we're looking for at all. So I said, well, I thought I'd give it a try. I've had a fair bit of experience golf-wise. Well, don't phone us, we'll phone you. So a week later, the advert was in again. So I phoned him up and said, how are you getting on with your search for a professional? He says, oh, we've got about a dozen to interview yet. And I said, I should have mentioned that I'm a very low handicap player. I was playing off one, you see. And I said, I've done every job in a golf club. I've been captain at Keith Golf Club, secretary, match secretary, house convener, greens convener. I've done a lot. Oh, but you're 60. Yes, that's right. Oh, you're really not what we're looking for. So a fortnight later, no sign of the advert in the paper. So I phoned him up again. I said, how are you getting on now for yourself? He said, two more to interview. I said, why don't you make it three? He said, you know, for your persistence, I think I will. So along I went for the interview, which it wasn't a brush off. It lasted an hour and a half. And I formed the impression that this poor bloke didn't really want a professional at all. What he wanted was a manager for his golf course. And I managed to convince him that I had the qualifications for this, and professionals didn't. So he said, oh, I'll let you know as soon as possible, as soon as I've seen the directors. Following day, he phoned up and said, you've got the job. So that was another 10 years of bliss as a golf professional come manager.
Would there have been any question of your staying on in the RAF at the end of the war?
No, not really. I mean, I was only an NCO for a start, and there was never any suggestion that I get a commission. You know, I'd scraped in by my education was very poor. I came from a fairly humble background. For instance, the commissioning board that I went up to, the first question was, what does your father do? I said, my father's an electrical engineer. I was rather proud of the fact. Oh, they lost interest after that. It's amazing. Didn't want to know. If I'd said, well, my father was an MC in the First World War, he was an officer. Oh, was he? Yes. That would have been different. But no.
What did you find the atmosphere was like in post-war Britain?
The atmosphere in...
The social atmosphere in post-war Britain.
In post-war Britain? Well, how would I... I don't suppose my case was typical, because I started off working in Glasgow, then got a posting to Perth. And in Perth, made a lot of friends. Lovely town. It was very upbeat, on the whole, I think. Although there were far more political arguments between people at that time than nowadays. You hardly find anybody arguing politically. Well, not in this neck of the woods, anyway. Yes.
Had you been involved in the 1945 elections?
45 elections when Churchill was deposed and Attlee. Yes, I voted in the 45 elections. I can remember the forces vote, in fact, deposed Churchill. And of course, with my background, I was pretty strong Labour all the time. And I can remember being caught up to a certain extent in the euphoria of an Iron Bevan starting the health service, this kind of thing. But not a lot, nothing very intense, put it that way.
What do you remember of V-Day and VJ-Day themselves?
If I remember it at all. Oh, yes, I do remember VJ-Day. Because I was at Grangemouth, a station warrant officer at the time. Now, we had 120 prisoners. First of all, Italian, and then German. Well, on the airfield, which had been an operational training unit, was now a bomb dump. And the runways were loaded with dumps of 500 pounds American RDX bombs. And it was... My job as station warrant officer to organise the labour parties of prisoners to load these bombs onto trucks which were taken to the railway station, put on a train and then taken to Silliton Solway and dumped in the Beaufort Snake in the Irish Sea. Well, just before VJ night, the town council had organised a big bonfire in the local public park, which was adjacent to the airfield. And somebody had come to me and said, look, that bloody bonfire's hell of a sight too near your bomb dumps. So I said, oh, so it is, yes. So I went and had a look at it with the CO. And there was only one officer on the station, that was Dick Slee, the CO, who wasn't interested in anything much and left everything to me. And we went down to the public park and had a look at the bonfire, which was huge. You know, it hadn't been set right there, of course. And, my God, if the wind's in the wrong direction, it's going to carry the sparks right over onto the airfield. Went down and saw the provost of Grangemouth. I explained to him that this is really dangerous, I said. And I think the words I used were, do you really want to see Grangemouth out in the middle of the North Sea? Said, because that's going to happen if you light that bloody bonfire off. Oh, he said, well, tomorrow, he said, this was the day before VJ Day. He said, I'll get it shifted. I'll get somebody over early in the morning and we'll dismantle it.